I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. It's amazing how much and how little can change in the space of 2 years. Here in Boston, it's marathon day. Thousands of runners competed, and pasta is what a lot of them want to eat right now. That's what has not changed. But enough happened 2 years ago that it's hard for the marathon to feel normal. At the finish line that day, two brothers, two backpacks, and two bombs. Three people killed, more than 200 wounded. That day changed the marathon, the way we think of it, the way authorities try to protect it. We'll hear more about the changes to security in a moment. First, though, to my WGBH colleague, Philip Martin, at the finish line. Philip, a rainy day and cooler temperatures set the scene for us. Has it been large crowds even with this weather?
Yeah, Marco, as you said, a rainy day, damp, it is windy, but yet people have been coming out. But it's not just the rain they're dealing with. They're dealing with long lines to get into the viewing area to actually see the runners come in. They started queuing earlier today. Police have set up checkpoints at various points along the marathon near the finish line to guarantee that those who are bringing in bags, for example, that they those bags contain only essentials.
Yeah, so checkpoints were pretty heavy last year. Has there been any kind of additional technology or improvements to security this year that you've noticed?
Well, not really. I mean, it's pretty much the same as it was last year. Last year, of course, you had much better weather, so you had a lot more people, I think. And I think that folks, though, even though they endured the security lines, for the most part, they felt that it was a good idea.
So despite the rain and extra security, the mood today, celebratory or still a little bittersweet?
It's funny. It was a little subdued, but I saw quite a few people high-fiving each other as they're standing there talking to one another and talking to strangers. And people seem to be pretty much, I would say, overall in a good mood, though it hardly matches the type of mood that accompanied the one-year anniversary, where folks felt defiant, and it was clear. Today, they were here to watch the race, and I think with a mixture of reflection on what happened in 2013 and to see folks coming into the finish line as they've watched this race for over 100 years.
Philip Martin with our partners here at WGBH Boston, speaking with me from the finish line at the Boston Marathon. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Marco.
One thing I find hard to forget about 2 years on was the gunfire on the streets of Watertown right before the capture of Johar Tsarnaev. The use of firepower was intense.
The use of rifles by police has increased dramatically since 9/11. These weapons, unlike sidearms that are only good to 100 yards, these things can go for miles. So it's a very, very serious issue that needs to be addressed.
That's Ed Davis, former Boston Police Commissioner, responding to a report that recently came out about that use of force in the Watertown shootout. Davis spoke with Julia Kayyem, former Assistant Secretary in the Department of Homeland Security, and now host of the podcast Security Mom. She says it was not the shootout in Watertown that forced authorities to address the issue.
It wasn't really the Boston Marathon that changed it. It was actually Ferguson. President Obama and a variety of governors and others are now looking at the equipment that has been distributed to these local police departments without training and changing who gets what and for how long. So one important change that's starting to be made is that the distribution of military type equipment can only go to police departments with dedicated, you know, SWAT or military like teams. In other words, you just don't want the guy on the street or the gal on the street having this. That is a good reform. It's just going to take a couple years for it to be played out fully.
I think a lot of people around the country were shocked by the amount of weaponry on the streets of Watertown, and then again with Ferguson last summer. Is there a thorough inventory of where some of the most lethal hardware is in the U.S. right now?
No, and they're starting to be. So here's been the challenge. I think it's called federalism is the challenge. What happened after 9/11 was tens of billions of dollars were distributed to the precursor to the Department of Homeland Security, which was the Department of Justice. And it's essentially distributed to governor's offices or major city mayor's offices who then distribute it to their police departments who then buy what they feel that they need. There just weren't that many restrictions on it.
Right.
And we sort of forgot the basic and best tenet of all policing is community policing. You don't terrorize your neighborhoods. And we've learned that lesson mostly through Ferguson and post-Ferguson police shootings that have occurred just in the last 6 months.
When we talk terror response writ large, we got to talk about the color-coded alert system.
Yes.
And you also spoke with Michael Chertoff, who was the Secretary of Homeland Security under George W. Bush, who told you that there were obvious problems with making the color-coded alert system public. Let's hear what he had to say.
A couple of things became evident. One is it doesn't make sense to raise it generally. You ought to be more specific about either a location or a particular type of function like transportation. So you give people a little bit more guidance. Second, the lowest level was green. It was evident we were never going to be in green.
All right. So let me ask you first, Julia Keim, why was the color-coded system never going to go green?
No government is going to guarantee perfect security because there's no such thing as perfect security. So from the get-go, the color code system that Michael Chertoff inherited was flawed in its design. It wasn't supposed to be public. It was a way to talk to public safety officials about what they should know. And so now there's no color code system. There's something called the National Terrorism Advisory System. It's more of a narrative, and it just tells people, look, we're a little bit worried about the mass transportation system, so you're going to see more transit police on the transit system. But I'm pretty convinced now that since it wasn't utilized during the Boston Marathon bombings, it will never be used.
Finally, Juliet, I'm curious to know from you as a mom, because, well, your podcast is, after all, called Security Mom. We had two young men, the Tsarnaevs, plant these bombs. As a mother, do you think grown-ups are doing the best they can for young people?
We owe the next generation honesty about the world that they're inheriting, the skills and tools necessary to sort of protect themselves and their future families, and the capacity to just basically pivot and respond when they need to. I mean, the whole point of the podcast is it's not good parenting to put your head under the sand and pretend, you know, nothing bad is happening. That as parents, we equip ourselves in all sorts of ways to protect our children. They are the same skills necessary to protect our nation, right?
Security expert Julia Keim. She is the host of the new podcast, Security Mom. Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.